The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China's exports crash. Huge disappointment with the jobs report. Markets closed down on the week, and Draghi looks pretty spooked. Our guest today, David Morgan from The Morgan Report. All this and much more on episode number 603 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So glad you're joining me again this week and every week. Discover some new and cool things in the area of finance, investing, and the overall area of just what's going on with our money. Hopefully you're well rested, though we lost an hour of sleep. Yep, changing back the clocks. Hopefully I'll get a little bit more sleep, because I think I mentioned this on last week's DH Unplugged episode that we do on Tuesday nights. I said, it seems like, I don't know, when the clocks changed this time, somehow my body was like up at the time that it was before. I don't know. Something happened. I wasn't able to sleep really well through the night, but maybe it's me. Maybe I'm getting older. You know how that goes. Anyway, these days, you know, it's funny. You have to do only a few clocks, because back in the day, those people that had grandfather clocks and regular clocks that you'd wind up or any other clocks, you know, we had to actually set clocks, go around the house. I have a couple of ovens that aren't automatic, but other than that, all the clocks in my house and watches and things like that seem to be automatic. For those of you that don't remember that, it was a time that you never had the exact time anywhere in the house, because you would just, you know, you'd go from one clock to one clock. You'd have maybe a couple of people set up in the house saying, okay, set it now. And then hopefully everything was lined up. Well, let's talk about the week. What a week we had. We started out slow and it got worse as it went on. The 10-week streak for markets being up are now broken. And looking back, I think if you look back on this, I don't think it's anybody could say, oh, that was really unexpected, because we had this crazy move over the last 10 weeks that was pretty much straight up from the lows. It was really nothing that could really hit the markets. Any news that came out that was negative, people were like, it's temporary, it's transient, don't worry about it, and things are going to get better. Valuations are low, we're constructive with the markets. You've seen this on television, you've read about this in newspapers, online, even heard about it on radio and podcasts. You know, there's a lot of people who thought that that move in December was a little bit outsized. I was one of them. I did think it was outsized. Now I'm starting to think we've reached the top of our range here. Clearly, the triple tops that we've seen over the last several weeks that have become resistance levels have not been able to be broken. So with that, and with the thought that we saw some numbers out on economics combined with a little bit of a lackluster guidance period during earnings season, I think we're starting to recognize that the global economy is starting to slow. In fact, during the week, there was some pretty ugly news. So some of the things that I really picked up on this week as curious, something I said, you know, there's a few things that are starting off the week besides the fact that we got that very well-timed tweet right before the Sunday market futures opened, of course, to try to convince us that we're really close to a China deal when we're really not. The hope to manipulate markets a little bit higher on the open over. That was kind of something I thought was curious. Okay, especially even with the fact that we saw futures move up higher after these kinds of comments, especially on Sunday nights. But the follow through the last couple of weeks on Monday was not impressive. I also noticed that if you hadn't watched Draghi or heard about Draghi or read the testimony that he provided for the ECB conference, I think it's worth noting because he physically seemed scared. He looked scared. He sounded scared. He discussed this significant slowdown that he's seeing in Europe over the next year or so. And he did not exude a presence of confidence that anything that they could do at the ECB would be able to offset this. They kept rates the same as it has been, but they restarted and talked about their bond buying program again, hoping that maybe somehow the bond buying program that didn't work to begin with will actually help things get a little bit better. Remember something. In Europe, the difference between the Europe and the USA and specifically related to the banks is that they pretty much just covered up their bad banking issues, hope for the best, whereas in the United States, we made some real progress on cleaning up the balance sheets of our major banks. In Europe, it's been a mess. Look at the European bank stock prices. Not only haven't they recovered, some of them are at or below their 2008 lows. That should be telling you something right there. And I think that when we look at Europe, they structurally do not have the tools or the ability or desire. They don't have the desire to really clean up their act because you have all these different countries that are involved, different rules, different banking laws. So you have this, you have the ECB, which is the central bank, of course, and they're able to provide liquidity, lower interest rates, try to do things to shore up the banks by buying their bonds, but they really don't have the regulatory environment that is consistent with helping the banks in total. So what you see is these banks struggling. And if you have a problem in your financial sector and with the banking industry, not much can follow well from there. Really can't get much good out of that. So when Draghi is out there looking a little pale, a little concerned, a little bit worried, and then he's starting to come up with some kind of cockamamie ideas about maybe going back to negative interest rates and maybe even restarting and in fact, restarting the quantitative easing program called the LTROs, then it can be taken in two ways. And this was the issue and I think the rub this week. In particular, that we're looking at this bad news now as bad news. Because now we're in a situation where while it is good to see lower interest rates overall and a more, I would say, cooperative Fed and central bank around the world, the fact is you have to wonder, wait a second, if Draghi's so concerned, this is the point, if Draghi's so concerned and he's doing something drastic, and we saw that change in the Fed here where they are basically within a few-week period doing a 180-degree turn on rates, and massive stimulus from China and Japan talking about, again, going towards various stimulative measures. You have to wonder if there's a little bit more or a lot more that is really underlying some of the concern and what they see. I have made the case, and I will stick by it, that we are entering in that time period that I discussed that is going to be this fall off of economic growth due to the tariffs. The pull-forward effect. It is playing out perfectly. Markets, how are they going to react? That's another story entirely. But what is happening is we saw another point on this discussion where China's reported an absolute plunge, this disaster when it came to their exports. This is on top of their discussion about slowing their growth expectations from 6.6, 6.7 to about 6 to 6.5. Big range for China. But now we have this pull forward effect that's really playing out. If you don't remember what I talked about, that go to the disciplinedinvestor.com. There's a couple of articles on this. We saw a 20% drop in exports. This is what we've been worried about. China's markets plunged on the news, 4.4%. Now, with all due response to the idea that, well, this is after their markets are up 19% for the year. Absolutely. But now all of a sudden, there's some reality hitting home. The numbers are clear. There's no more speculation about, hey, are the tariffs going to hurt? And did we see a significant amount of buying and front-loading into the time when the tariffs will probably increase? And I think the answer is a resounding yes. And then on top of that, where we saw that Draghi was scared and we saw that China is now reporting some very problematic and concerning numbers out of their economy, we've been seeing some slowdown in factory numbers and a few other areas, of course. The jobs number on Friday. Now, in all fairness, I do think that there was a bit of an aberration in some of these numbers. It could have been for a variety of reasons. Why exactly did we only see a 20,000 addition to the payrolls for the period, while we also saw a drop of the unemployment rate from 4% to 3.8%? A little strange. There's no question that the disappointment in the number, where we were expecting about 175,000 being added and only get 20, there's something wrong there. The biggest drop was in construction and in hospitality. So the two things that I could probably tell you about this, that reading between the lines, is this. That the number in the construction, the big drop-off, could be and possibly is related to weather. There's also probably some impact from the slowdown in construction and housing and all that. But there was a weather event. That could be one of them. The second thing, it could be some government shutdown, maybe blended in there somehow. I don't know if it's a lot, but there could be some impact from the government shutdown somewhere in this. But the other thing is the hospitality industry. You have to wonder if that area really got hit in the latest period due to the fact that the markets coming down in October, November, December of last year, and the reduction and slide of consumer confidence during that period pushed people to hold off on spending on discretionary dollars, particularly on travel and maybe even some restaurants and dining and everything related. Maybe they were saying, you know what, until things clear up, until I can get some good feeling that markets are stabilizing, I'm not booking anything. I'm not going out as much. I'm not going to make long-term plans. And this is the problem when we have markets that are such a key component to our overall economy. What happens is that what the market does creates an economic result. I asked this question several weeks ago. I said, is a recession caused by a market correction or a market crash? Or is a market correction or crash caused by a recession? Think about that. Think about that for a second. Which came, it's a classic, you know, chicken or egg, right? We don't know. But if in fact this whole idea of a slowdown in the area of hospitality in particular is because of this market correction that we saw and the impact on consumer confidence, there's something to be said about being careful with trying to keep markets up as best as possible, which is the job of the Fed and the job of the government and all that. This is their new job. The Fed's job is not just inflation and their dual mandate of keeping employment, all that. No, it's also keeping asset prices stable, which just for those of you that need a definition, that equals stock markets, bond markets. So it's no wonder that the markets took a breather this week. We're in this overbought condition after 10 weeks up, and it was really growing, and we get some bad news that came out. The S&P finished down about 2.2%, another major rally almost to get the S&P positive for the day on Friday in the anticipation of some hopeful news over the weekend. That's what's going on Friday. It's a really weird condition this year where we're seeing Fridays pretty strong. But it was down. The S&P was down, like I said, 2.5%. NASDAQ down about 2.4%. Small caps down about 4.2% for the week. Those have been the strongest. So a couple things I want to get to before we get to our guest really quickly. I want to mention that on Fridays, each and every Friday, I host a technical trading session with TradeStation called the Morning Market Briefings. So I put on my trigger charts hat, and you can go over there. It's about a half hour before the market opens, 9 to 9:30. Go over to TradeStation and just simply Google TradeStation University and search for TradeStation University. When you get there, click on Morning Market Briefings. sign up for it, and you'll get a code that you can come in on 9 o'clock into the conference, into the webinar. It's free at 9 a.m. on Fridays. And we have a very, very fast-paced discussion about the areas that are impacting markets that day, what to look for in the market throughout the day, as well as earnings, stocks to watch, and themes of the week. So make sure to check that out. Do that. All right. I think we're done with this. Of course, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you have a question, comment, criticism, just go over to the button on top that says Ask Andrew and type away. Send it on in. I love getting your feedback. If you're sitting out there and you're thinking about something and you like the guest, you don't like the guest, you have something to add to my discussion, a clarification, correction, or even a question of your own, I'd love getting your feedback. So this is a two-way discussion. Even though I'm the one with the microphone, you have the typewriter. You have, well, keyboard. Shows my age there. You have the keyboard. Go on over there and send in your comments. With that, how about we get to our guest? And our guest today is David Morgan. And his main focus is educating people about how to generate great profits from the resource sector. And he's been, his ideas actually been in the movie Four Horsemen, which we'll talk about. And he publishes the Morgan Report for the last 20 years or so. And he's been all over TV. You've probably seen him before. An expert in the area of precious metals and resources and all that. So, David, how are you?
Well, I'm doing quite well, thank you. I had a miserable cold at the Anarchapoco event, but I'm over it and I'm raring to go.
Raring to go. That's good. That's good. So I guess the first question I have to ask is that, you know, there's all sides in the markets, right? So there's equities and there's futures and there's commodities and there's, how did you and why are you looking at, you know, primarily the resource sector, and what's the, you know, how do you get your interest in that?
Well, I got interested in honest money when I was 11 years old, and the currency or the coinage was changed from 90% silver coins to what I call Johnson slugs in 1965. And common sense told me that those new quarters and dimes could not be worth the old, the same as the old ones. But both adults around me didn't seem to be paying much attention. So that kind of piqued my curiosity. It wasn't at that point in time where everything came together. But I had an interest in it, and I just, it was kind of an open question. So as the years marched by and I got into, you know, seventh, eighth grade, whatever, started looking at, you know, civics, it became apparent to me that, you know, constitutionally gold and silver are money, and, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be, but yet it's not. And so I started looking a little deeper, and I determined, a bit to my surprise when I discovered it, because, you know, it's one of that aha moments that everybody has and some part of their life, and usually multiple times. For me, it was that aha every time that a government has gone off an honest money standard, there's been a huge financial debacle of some sort. Mm-hmm. And it then goes in, I wouldn't call it chaos, but there's a readjustment. Common word these days is reset.
A reset.
And then things come back to normal. And normally, the short version, which is very, very abbreviated, but it's fiat. Things go to heck, back to gold standard, common sense prevails, off back on the fiat, things go into chaos or, you know, uncertainty, back to gold. So it's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I mean, this is not like a new thing that's never happened before. But what's unusual about it is it's global in scope.
But now, what's interesting is that you would, when you know, use the word common sense quite often, and you use honest money and all that, but what's interesting is that you would think, just generally think, that what we've seen over the last 10 years, where there's been a major debasement of currencies and where there's been, I would say, a whole heck of a lot of chaos, you would have seen some of these metals do a lot better than they have been doing. Doesn't that seem a little bit disjointed to you?
No, it is. I mean, you know, I do not like to put the manipulation card out there and hide behind it at constantly. And, you know, a few of my colleagues kind of do that in my view. But the truth of the matter is all markets are manipulated, and I can prove it to you probably in less than a minute. I mean, basically, the whole premise of the financial system is based on the future value of money, that a dollar is going to be worth less at some point in time, you know, in the future than it is right now. And so the interest rates are established on both what is the projected loss of purchasing power and how much of a real return do you want on that money. And so if you manipulate the interest rates at a at any scale, and it's at a global scale, I mean, the Fed and the powers that be manipulate the interest rates. If you manipulate the interest rates on money and do not let the free market determine what the true risk to reward ratio should be, in other words, what the true interest rate should be, you therefore have manipulated everything, because everything starts with the currency markets. And so now it trickles down throughout all aspects, stocks, the bond market that I just mentioned, really, it's the debt credit markets. And then, of course, it moves into the commodities, with the real standout being the silver market. I mean, supply and demand have to meet every year. And the problem with the futures markets as they are today is that as long as the settlement occurs where both parties are satisfied, meaning that, geez, I bet silver's going up and I got my check for winning, or I bet silver's going down and I got my check for winning, as long as the settlement process satisfies the marketplace, the market can produce as much silver out of thin air as they want. So really what we have is not only a fractional reserve currency system, we have a fractional reserve gold and silver market, because most of the time, people that stand for delivery or take possession is a tiny fraction of the amount of paper that's out there. For example, most commodities, this is not just silver, is sitting in about the 2 or 3% range versus what the amount of paper against that commodity is.
I mean, this is the problem where people who believe that there should be a currency backed with some kind of, you know, the old Fort Knox, right? You know, what's in Fort Knox? Well, nothing in theory, or it's jam-packed with stuff in theory. Who knows, right? What the real answer is and what's really backing all this. And that's the big secret of our day. And when you have a currency that is based on the full faith and credit of fill in the blank is where some of those problems come in. But as you're saying, and I think I agree with you, when you have at the same time a Fed that is manipulating things around that, you don't get the true valuation of that particular currency. And this is why there's been such discussion about China and other countries being currency manipulators. I mean, the U.S. is the biggest currency manipulator out there, don't you think?
Amen. Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, we have a privilege that no one else has. We're able to print money at will and force it on other countries to take it. I mean, that's a privilege that no one else has. And yet we, you know, hide behind the Chinese. Look, most people have their own self-interest at heart. And that's just common sense. It's the way we're made. But that doesn't mean most people are, you know, psychopathic or sociopathic. I mean, they have their best interest at heart, but they're also, most people, willing to look at the other side and make a compromise or serve both parties or whatever. In the currency markets, that applies as well. So it's only natural that a nation state would look and see what's in their best interest. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. We, on the other hand, say, look, the dollar is the reserve currency. And if you don't like it, look at this, you know, look down the barrel of a gun.
Right.
I mean, it sounds rather pointed, but I'm making the point, because that's exactly what happens. I mean, the only countries that we seem to have real problems with are the very few left that aren't on the Anglo-American Empire banking system. Iran, that's one. You've got
Russia,
North Korea.
Yeah.
And, Cuba or whatever. I mean, there's very few countries that aren't in, quote unquote, the system, which I call the global banking system, which is basically run out of London and New York, primarily London.
Right. And the same thing with the IMF is basically run by the U.S. But let's talk a little bit about energy here, because energy is kind of fascinating to me. I mean, a very manipulated market. And I'm talking about specifically right now, let's talk about crude oil, where we are seeing, you know, it's funny because the commentary that comes out of OPEC, if it was done by a layperson, they'd be put in jail with all the discussions, the lies, the forward thinking about production and cuts or enhancements, or just their general desire to manipulate the markets. Where are we in terms of the cycle of energy right now?
I think we're in a situation where, you know, we have a quote unquote abundance of oil currently, but it's a very thin margin, much less than most people would think based on the price performance of the oil market. So what I mean is that, we don't have the huge amount of storage, this overhang. There is some, but it's not really that great. And, you know, people say, oh, there's all this oil out there. I'm not convinced. And I studied this topic pretty hard. I mean, if really we had all this oil everywhere, would we be fracking? Would we be in Canada in the tar sands? Would we be doing all the things that we are doing? That's an absolute total fact. to get more oil if it was so abundant? And the answer is, of course not. So I think common sense, again, can prevail if you think about it. The reason we're going in these directions of fracking and tar sands is because the actual oil supply is not as great as, let's say, the oil proponents are touting.
But when you talk about oil supply, you're not talking about the actual supply that's been brought up, either refined or in storage right now. You're talking about below the ground.
That's correct. I'm looking at what is the availability. I mean, my favorite, I just started an energy report, as you know, and if you're interested, just go to comingenergyboom.com and get the free webinar. Go through a lot of details in that webinar. But I did I've only done a few reports. One is EROI, energy return on energy invested. And this is where you really have to accurately look at how much it costs to get any energy, be it solar, be it wind, be it wave energy from the ocean, be it biomass. I don't care. So how much energy do you get out of a solar panel? Well, that could be calculated. But how much energy went into producing that solar panel, getting that solar panel truck to your, to your business? How much labor and cost did it take to put it on the roof, secure it, put all the cabling in and hook it up? So there's a cost to these free energy ideas. And when you say renewable, it's renewable for what, 10 years, 12, 15? How long is that solar panel good for before it's got to have maintenance or whatever? So none of this stuff is really as, let's say, big a solution as they're purported to be. And that's something people need to be cognizant of, because the whole world runs on energy. And the more energy everybody has, the more prosperous everybody is. And there are solutions to the problem, but they're basically overlooked.
So let me ask you this. How is electricity produced? It's a simple question, but I'm going somewhere with this.
Yeah, so there's several ways, as you know. I mean, primarily, it's used by burning fossil fuels. You can burn natural gas, you can burn oil, you can burn coal, primarily a lot of coal. It's turned into electricity. Of course, you can do it from the big windmills that are out there that's wind generated, and of course, solar as well. So those are the primary ways to generate electricity.
The best way
is hydropower. I mean, have a dam, spill it across the spillway, have it turn the turbine and produce electricity. That's really a great way to produce electricity.
The reason why I ask is because, just to tackle what you mentioned earlier, when you look at these various energy sources, the renewable energy, a lot of things come to mind for people where, hey, it's clean. We're not ruining the ozone layer, or we're not ruining our environment and all that. And that's why I'm buying an electric car, right? And this whole idea, this misnomer that if you use an electric car, it is a really light footprint in terms of a carbon emission, where in fact, let's just talk back to what you just said. How do you get energy, though?
Exactly. I give you a hug. I give you an electric hug, and I'm straight. But I mean, really, that's the exact point. People are hypocrites without even knowing that they are. Oh, I drive a Prius or whatever. Good for you. And look, I'm free market. You want to drive a Prius, drive a Prius. But let's acknowledge the fact, and I'm going to use solar panels as an example, of how many toxic chemicals are used in the production of a solar panel. But, oh, I'm clean. I went solar. I'm off grid. I'm solar. And they puff their chest out, probably because they're ignorant. And I don't like to use that word, but it's true. They're ignorant of the fact of what it really took to make that solar panel, how toxic it was, what kind of chemicals were used, et cetera. And you're making the point again. I'm driving an EV. The problem with me, this is my take, and, I'll get my hate mail, but that's okay, is not only the ignorance, but it's almost some of these. This is my experience. Doesn't mean it's across the board. These people kind of get a little bit arrogant about, I'm better than you because I drive an electric vehicle, or I'm better than you because I'm on solar, or I'm better than you because my carbon footprint is less than yours is. Is it really? Let's factor in everything and see if it's less than mine.
Why? Why bother doing that? Let them live in their world of make-believe. I mean, let them just be part of the whole, the ideal generation that doesn't look at facts. They just look at the superficial headline, or if it's on Facebook, therefore it must be true.
Well said.
Let's not spoil that party.
My stress level. Let it be.
So let's talk about crude for a second. Get back to that for one moment. One of the things is that when people trade, first of all, I mean, commodities in the area of futures is a very dangerous game. I don't care how good you are or bad you are with it. They move pretty quickly, even though you only have to put up a certain amount of money. I mean, you can go underwater pretty quickly with this. But one of the things that happens that people really don't understand, I think, is the very nature and the framework of the commodities markets and the futures markets when it comes to the idea of two terms that seem to just scare the bejesus out of people, which is contango and backwardization. Can you explain what that means and how that impacts the markets? And then we'll go into maybe some of the areas like, for example, the commodity ETFs, how they are impacted.
Sure. So you can look it up on, you know, Bing or Google or whatever, just maybe get a better definition than mine. But contango is normal spread between what we call the spot or the near month and a future contract later in the year. So for an example, you could have the spot month in crude, and a year from now, that contract will sell for today's price plus a premium because of the interest rate. It all comes back to the interest rate that we talked about a while back. So it's a spread, and that's called the contango.
So that's when we expect that prices will be higher in the future.
Well, we expect not necessarily that the price will be higher in the future. We expect that the interest rate on that money or on that commodity needs to be taken into account, because let's just look at it this way. Let's say that all that oil really exists. It doesn't, but let's just pretend it does. Doesn't matter what I'm saying here. What matters is that it's a cost. There's a cost to hold that oil, right? And what is the cost? Well, the cost is, let's say, 1.5% between this month and a year from now. So instead of being X, it's X plus 1.5% more because of the future. So it's a premium on the time. It's a time premium. And it's basically an interest rate is what it is.
Mm-hmm. And the reverse is true for backwardation.
Now, backwardation is very interesting, because backwardation means that the spot month, the near month, the contract month, sells for a higher price than a month out in the future. And this rarely happens. In almost all cases, what it means is that there is a short squeeze on that particular commodity. People are willing to pay almost any price to get it now. I've got to have it now. So like in the gold market, silver market, oil market, whatever, it does go into backwardation from time to time. Usually they're alleviated within a few days. Usually there's enough of the product out there, the commodity out there, to satisfy that I've got to have it now demand. And once that's satisfied, then we go back into contango. But if you go into backwardization, and if you ever see it in the metals and it's there for more than about 4 days in a row, you better buy some like pronto, because if it can't clear within usually 3 or 4 days, that would mean that there's a run of the month, you know, run into gold, run into silver, what have you, that would cannot be met by the market. And if the market understands that, which it would at some point, look out, because everybody that owns it won't sell it. They'll hold it and buy more. And that'll cause a buying frenzy. And once a buying frenzy happens, they would probably have to put the circuit breakers on the futures market, stop trading the futures, and you probably get the disparity that we've all talked about for years, where you have a real honest-to-God price for the physical metal and you have a paper price, and they would not be the same.
Yeah. And then delivery is the issue. Hey, exactly. We're back. You know what? Here, 5 barrels? Yes, sirree. Delivering tomorrow. What is your favorite security to trade for these markets? So let's take energy for a second. Let's take oil, natural gas. Is it the futures?
XLE for the energy. I like the ETF. It's easy. It's clean. It's, you know.
But that's actually equities in there.
Yeah, but that's one I like to use. I do equities. I'm not going to tell you which ones I've got on the list because I'm just getting started on this. So we mix in both, but I think ETFs are a pretty clean way to go. I think they're a little cleaner to work with for most people than the futures. The futures, as you said, I mean, usually about 98% of people lose money in the future. So why bother? Yeah. You know, forget it. Let's look for a better. I like the equities because there's a different dynamic. I mean, if we have a situation that's, you know, let's say a mid-tier, it's got, you know, pipelines and it's got a growth factor and they've got, you know, potential out in the future. Yeah, that's a good situation. I mean, there's a lot to it, and it's a very exciting. I mean, there's nothing to me more exciting, really, than the resource sector in general and the energy sector in particular. I mean, I love the metals and always will, but energy is a very exciting field, especially with all of the pressure in on the planet, I would say, to get, you know, more energy deliverable to more people and make it clean and easier said than done, as we have discussed already.
So there, I know you do a letter called Energy Stock Profits.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. That primarily focuses on energy and energy stocks, I assume.
Correct. Yeah, I look at the gamut, but most of the stuff is still, you know, primarily, you know, fossil fuels. But I'm going to address and will address and have addressed lots of looks into, and pretty deep looks into, alternatives. I mean, one thing that's very hardly ever mentioned on any interview anywhere is thorium.
I was just going to mention that to you.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's a big one on my list. That's right on the top of my list, thorium. Yeah. Tell me about it.
I have it. You know, I'm not studied enough to sit here and puff out my chest and say it is the solution. There are people that are probably better studied than I on thorium that say it is. I'm not certain, but what I do know is it's overlooked for a variety of reasons. And this gets into, you know, the political system and all that, which I'm not really wishing to go into at this moment in time. But I want my people, I should say my people, maybe that sounds a little arrogant, but I want anyone that is a subscriber to the Energy Stock Profits to have the ability to look really big picture, really far and wide, because, you know, I want this to touch as many people as possible. So it's certainly not going to be me at my age, but it might be somebody my age's grandson or granddaughter that gets the report through their grandparent and says, look at this, and really gets into the thorium situation and goes, yeah, this is, you know, I'm devoting my life to this or whatever, because there are solutions out there, but it seemed to be, you know, I hate to say, make everything a conspiracy. I don't, you know, if there are conspiracies, I don't see one under every tree, just about every other tree, but regardless, you really wonder if the oil cartel, I'll call it, has a grip on the, let's say, the direction that our energy usage is going. And I certainly believe that's the case.
Just to let everybody know, thorium is a weakly radioactive metallic, weakly W-E-A-K-L-Y, radioactive metallic chemical element with a symbol TH and the atomic number of 90. And it is, there are no nuclear or thorium reactors, but there is thoughts that you can compare to things like uranium and other types of nuclear based energy, I guess is the point there on the thorium, right?
Right. I think the best thing to do is just go to YouTube and type in thorium and look at a few videos. There's some that are very, very good, some that are so-so. But the idea is that it's really not as nearly radioactive as uranium. So it's very safe.
Right.
And it's very plentiful. And there's, you know, it would basically, again, I'm not going to state this publicly because I really don't know, but there are people that have stated that there's enough thorium just hanging out that's easily accessible to power the whole world without any problem whatsoever at all. In fact, not only powered as it stands now, like double or triple, and the cost, once implemented, is next to nothing. So here's a solution, or at least it appears to be a solution. I want to use my words carefully. That is totally overlooked, and you have to. That begs the question, why? Then it comes back to, I think we have an idea that the oil cartels certainly pushing us one way.
Yeah, but there's got to be some. I mean, there's a TED Talk from Kirk Sorensen, Thorium, an Alternative Nuclear Fuel. So you can look that
up. It's an excellent one. Yep. And I was on his website for a few hours. I looked at everything on his website.
Interesting.
And he's caught the bug, and he is making progress. It's tough. I mean, you know, as everything takes capital, everything takes money. We can't, you know, you have to have money to live. And, you know, he's got to get people to fund him. But he's doing a good job, and he caught the bug, and he does a great job. That's a great lecture to watch.
I mean, there are some really neat alternative energy stocks out there, and you know, they usually are volatile, they're usually thin, they usually, you know, I mean, you have some that are like like solar panels, right? You know, there's some of those. But look at what happened with Solar City. It had to be absorbed by Elon Musk in his in Tesla. You know, that was a bust, whether it was a bad idea or whatever. But you would think that, you know, solar, especially out west in California, where that's such a, you know, an area that really loves alternative energies, that would be good. But somehow it didn't seem to work. So when it comes to energy, you're pretty bullish on the whole energy environment. What about gold? Let's talk about gold. And do you use ETFs for that too, like GLD?
Well, I specialize in gold stocks, and certainly, because there's a lot of leverage in the right stocks. But there's a certain class of stocks that basically make money on gold, whether the price goes up or down. And that's a really sweet feeling to have. Plus, they pay dividends. So that's what we specialize in. And then, you know, we go across the board. That's our top tier. And then we move into the mid-tier and speculative stocks. So, you know, most of the gold industry is just riddled with these ad copywriters that write these this ad copy that's just so phenomenal. When I read it, I want to buy the stuff. I mean, it's
like, how to make 1,800% in the next 4 weeks.
That's right. Yeah. You got it. That's just a start. That's going to go from there. You know? Right. And after you buy your second yacht, you know, it's just like crazy.
Do you think that actually, you know, speaking about this crazy notion of making these kind of returns, do you think that there was a break in the use of physical commodities in terms of alternative assets for protection safety when the cryptocurrency craze happened? And that's why possibly there's a little bit less interest in there. Although, who the hell wants the cryptocurrencies anymore? You know, they kind of bombed out. But do you think there was something going on there that the people that maybe were the, quote, gold bugs, I'm not saying good or bad in that, but the gold bugs maybe shifted over to becoming crypto bugs?
Oh, absolutely. But I've looked into this. It's, you know, pretty far, and it's very difficult because it's anecdotal evidence for the most part. But I am connected with, like, every major retail dealer in the country. Well, I wouldn't say every, but most, 80%, 70%, and some of the major wholesalers. And it really affected the silver side more than the gold side. A lot of people that will buy silver and not gold are more high risk, and they will take – and so some of them took their, you know – overpriced $30 silver, cashed it out and went into Bitcoin at the right time or some alternative crypto and watched it run up and are very, very happy. And again, anecdotal evidence, but you know, it's not like one phone call to one dealer. I mean, this is across the board. So yes, it did have an effect, certainly more on the silver side than the gold side.
You know, one of the things that I find, I'll tell you a quick story if I may. A number of years ago when silver hit, what did it hit, 50 something? What was it? Mm-hmm.
Well, just under. Yeah,
just under 50. There was a guy that I met. I was at my lake house, and he was telling me all about his silver. All about it. Not that there's a lot you could talk about, but somehow he made it a full hour conversation about his silver. You know, I don't know what. Okay. I'm like, uh-huh. And he's talking about how, you know, it's his retirement plan. I said, listen, his name is Dickie. I said, Dickie, do me a favor. Consider, just for a second here, just consider maybe taking some of the profits off. You can always put it back in if you want. If it moves up, maybe take, you know, 25% or 50% off of the table. And maybe at that time, what you should do is just bank that. I don't even care if you put a CD or bond or something under the mattress, because you know what? Do you really think silver is going to stay where we are at this level right here? Oh, no. I'm not selling my silver ever. I said, but you got enough for retirement right now. Why don't you sell it? Nope, I'm not doing it. I'm thinking to myself, what an idiot. That's what I'm thinking to myself at the time, right? And what happened right after that? I mean, would it go down to 17?
Yeah. Something like that? And lower down. Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, this is the problem where you get caught up with the bug, or this is not only related to silver, gold, or currencies or commodities. It's any investment where you fall in love with them. I always say, you know what? The investment doesn't love you. You don't need to love it. The fact of the matter is, what you need to do is love it when it does kind of do what you want it to do, but you don't need to love it after that. Nobody's going to care. So kind of not necessarily talking about trading, but talking about having a realistic view of what's going on here. And I think a lot of people lose that when, especially they have some of the physical commodities. I mean, we've seen the same thing with Netflix. We've seen the same thing with, you know, people that own GE forever. They just hold on to it, just, you know, because they do. It's not how could anything happen to this? So I think it's just a quick word of warning, generally speaking, that, you know, you need to be careful on any of these investments, but more so, you know, don't fall in love with it. Use some common logic when it comes to that. You can find more information on David Morgan at comingenergyboom.com. Where else can they find you?
That's it. That's the best. I have another publication. You can go to themorganreport.com. Those are the two URLs.
Okay, great. Well, listen, we'll have you on. Hopefully you can provide us with an update on how things are going and also maybe on the future of what's happening with the energy markets. And, of course, the thoriumletter.com, which I got that URL, by the way.
Great.
All right, I'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Thanks for joining me. Here next week, we have guest Ross Gerber. Hopefully my voice comes back a little bit. I got a little bit of a something going on. A little bit of a ailment of some sort, cough and kind of a weird throat. But anyway, our guest next week is Ross Gerber, and he is going to bring us some interesting ideas because I've been following him on Twitter to find out what he's all about, what makes him tick. So
So it should be interesting. Join me again then. Tell your friends. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.